Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflicks.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
A long time ago, right now, in a galaxy far, far away, the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C., the Cinema Clash reviewed a very small, limited-budget independent film called Rogue One, A Star Wars Story.
Did we see that?
Were you able to find this no-name production?
Yeah, you know, I heard it was coming, and I do know a few people who were very eager to see it, and so, you know, I was tempted to skip it, but no, in the name of seeing as many good big movies as possible, I did go to this one.
I don't think I had to explain too much to you. I think you were somewhat able to follow along.
I was ready for Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. The thing I did need explaining was exactly where it fell into the whole sequence of Star Wars mythology, because my God, there have been so many movies, Charlie.
It's only number 8.
Number 8.
But it falls in as number 4.
And they're calling it an anthology, which is not the same as the prequels or the trilogies or the sequels.
But we'll get to that.
Yeah, anyway.
Afterwards is another little movie called La La Land, which many predict may win the whole year. It's won many awards already. Mm-hmm. Some predict it might already be falling off in popularity.
What?
I'll tell you why that is. I have a feeling you liked it.
I liked it. I la-la liked it a lot.
You la-la liked it. I have a heart of coal and I la-la liked it as well. Collateral Beauty, Will Smith. You're on your own. I didn't see it.
Yeah, well, it's another one. It's actually good. There were no real duds this week.
Oh, a lot of people might disagree with you. I've been seeing some words on the Twitter sphere
about Collateral Beauty.
Collateral Beauty.
Yeah. No, no, no. Then they must be people with hearts of coal.
And to wrap it up, it wouldn't be complete. It's not from France. It's not from France, but it's in French.
It's in French.
It's from Belgium, southern Belgium, Wallonia. Le Tout Nouveau Testament, the Brand New Testament. Love this movie. Man, I laughed my butt off.
Even I liked it, so there you go. Wait till we get to that one.
All right. Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Takes place right before Episode 4, A New Hope. Another strong female lead, just like last year's Daisy Ridley. Welcome, Felicity Jones. I want to say immediately after it ended, after I think it was 133 minutes or whatever, I noticed I didn't feel the same. There's no Jedi in it. It didn't feel like a Star Wars movie. It felt like a standard action thriller to me.
Until the very last scene.
That Jedi doesn't count.
Okay.
Because he's not in, you know,
no
he's,
spoilers,
not the he's not the protagonist.
Yeah, no spoilers here, but it is very much like a war movie, an Independence Day kind of thing, more than a traditional Star Wars movie in its vibe. I was okay with that. It sort of works as a standalone for people who are just seeing this movie and are not Star Wars aficionados. I think it's okay then for them too. It's a good little introduction for a new generation of Star Wars sci-fi fans. Yeah, it's a little different, but it's okay. To me, it was not as good as The Force Awakens. I like that one a lot more. There are some people who are just raving, ridiculously raving about this movie, calling it the best of the Star Wars movies, and I can't agree with that.
I've seen both extremes. I've seen the best one yet. I've seen the worst piece of filth yet. I think it's in the middle. It is a standalone, but man, you need to know your Star Wars to really get it. You need to know before, you need to know after. Otherwise, you're like, the Death Star means nothing to you. You know, and certainly the ending would mean nothing if you don't know anything else about Star Wars.
Yeah, you need to go in with a general sense of the plot and the idea that it all comes into play later, that this weapon of mass destruction known as the Death Star that's being developed by the evil empire will come into play in later movies. And so the idea of this one is that this ragtag band of rebels is going and stealing the plans for the Death Star to prevent the destruction of the planet. And so that's the gist.
It's an entire movie based off of one line in Episode 4,
yeah,
where Mon Mothma, who shows up in this movie, same actress, but all CGI. There's a couple actors that happens to. Says, we were able to steal these plans. A lot of Bothans died. You know, and then boom, they made a whole movie out of it. And it's directed by a man named Gareth Edwards. He is most well known for a small independent from a couple years ago called Monsters. I really liked it. Then 2 years ago, he did the remake of Godzilla, which was quite good, in my opinion. I really liked Godzilla, so they liked his look, they liked his mien, so they said, Gareth, here's this astronomical budget, do what you will. I heard there were massive reshoots. I don't know what it is they reshot, but apparently they were worried about it, and they went back to fix something. I don't know what it was. That's the rumor. And you mentioned Weapon of Mass Destruction. There are some real-world tie-ins to this movie, and I think it's along the lines of the last 15 years of counterterrorism warfare. You see insurgents in close urban alleys fighting stormtroopers with sniper fire and IEDs. You don't see such close-in warfare in other Star Wars films. This is the first.
That's true, and it's a relatively dark movie, but then there are elements of it that remind you of every other Star Wars movie. To me, it's the scrolling text at the beginning that reminds you that you're heading back to a galaxy.
And there was no scrolling text.
There was.
Nope.
Yes, there was.
I disagree. There was no da-da-da. You know, the music was not there,
it
and
was
there was no
music.
Word crawl. There was no word crawl.
It just said it wasn't one of those long word crawls,
no.
But it did indicate that it was in a galaxy far, far away.
No, they had the standard long time ago, galaxy far, far away,
yeah.
And that neon blue lettering.
Yeah.
But there's no yellow, there's no yellow three paragraphs of blah, blah, blah. There's none of that.
Yeah, but there's enough of a nod to a lot of things that are traditional Star Wars, and even though the music is done by a different person, it still has the same general tenor as
it's John
as
Williams
the previous.
Inspired,
it
but it is different enough to think, wow, this is not standard.
I mean, it felt standard enough to me when the movie began, and even though it's a little darker than most, thank goodness there is the light provided by the droid, which is my favorite character in this entire movie. This sarcastic droid that predicts a 96% chance of mission failure.
C-3PO is annoying. In those other movies, he is just annoying and he gets on my nerves. This guy, K2SO, voiced by Alan Tudyk, is funny.
He is funny.
He's got the best lines of the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
He is really, he's got, he's a droid with intense sarcasm.
My kind of guy.
And he's physical. When he kills humans, he's very physical about it. He's very happy when he finally gets his hand on a blaster. He's a funny dude.
Yeah. So that was the comic relief for me that was much needed in this movie. It's got girl power, which is nice, as you mentioned. You know, another strong female character lead.
Another orphan.
And another cute pilot, you know, that comes into play. He's like the rebel leader that, you know, that she works in conjunction with to...
Are you talking about Riz Ahmed or Diego Luna?
I liked Diego Luna.
He did not work for me.
Cassian?
He's this rebel intelligence officer who's got a hard edge because you see him kill a guy early on. And he's got orders, which comes up later. She says, how can you follow orders if you think they're wrong? But I have orders. And they get into it. He did not work for me. He is not... He did not seem like this leading man I was caring about.
He grew on me as the film progressed. So by 3/4 of the way in, I was liking him a lot more. And he was, you know, he had a sort of a little bit of a character arc there. So, but again, she's the powerhouse, and good for her.
What did you think, and I might be giving away my opinion on it, what did you think of Forrest Whitaker and his Battlefield Earth verbosity, just weirdness.
I just haven't really been loving him in these things lately. I just thought his role in Arrival was just so throwaway. And so this is another one where it's just a different makeup job. And so, you know, it's still playing this sort of military guy. And I thought he was fine, but I didn't really feel like it was... it just wasn't a big enough role, and so you kind of are expecting him to be in something that's a little meatier, and he was fine, but it wouldn't have mattered to me if it was Forrest Whitaker or anybody else.
His character just sticks out. I mean, for the first half of the film, they talk about him just all the time before we see him, and then he has a kind of a bit role, and then he disappears. it just didn't work for me, and I don't know why they did that. But in the end, standard Star Wars, par for the course. There's a big battle, some of it on the ground, some of it in space. The space guys are always waiting for the guys on the ground to do something so they can do their thing. You know, it's an intense scene. It's a powerhouse, but there's no Jedi, so I don't... These are just civilians. These are logistics people. These are the red shirts from Star Trek, and no one ever mourned a red shirt from Star Trek.
Well, and this is a movie that is strictly for the sci-fi fans. I mean, if you're not already into this genre, it's not a movie that I would ever say, oh, you've never seen a Star Wars movie? This is the one you should go see.
No.
It's just another Star Wars movie, and people who love Star Wars movies are going to see this one, and I think for the most part they'll be satisfied with it, and then we've got like four more coming down the pike in the next 5 years.
Well, I'm happy we got it. I will take all the Star Wars I can get, because I'm a big Star Wars fan, but I can tell the difference between really good ones, Revenge of the Sith, Empire Strikes Back, and the not-so-good ones, Phantom Menace.
The whole middle sequence. The three that somehow came between, like, 1999 and 2004 or something. And for me, the original Star Wars in 1977 and The Force Awakens 30 years later.
Same movie, by the way.
Same movie, but they both worked for me. So
I think this one will win the weekend.
It probably will, but I don't think it should. It's not the best movie.
What is the best movie this week?
Well, I actually think Collateral Beauty is good.
No.
You didn't let me finish. I think Collateral Beauty is actually a better movie than Rogue One. And La La Land is by far the best movie of the weekend. And I put myself up there as one of those people touting it as the best movie of the year.
Well, it won Best Picture of the Critics' Choice Awards, which just happened this past weekend. It won our Washington, D.C. Film Critics Best Picture. I think it won the New York Film Critics. It's raking up, but I heard that it might be losing steam, and you can kind of tell that today. When the SAG Awards, the Screen Actors Guild Awards, were released, Manchester by the Sea got the most nominations. La La Land did not get nominated in Best Ensemble. Granted, it's a two-headed film.
Right.
But Best Ensemble is code for Best Picture.
This doesn't fit into that, though. And one of the reasons that I liked it so much is that it can't be pigeonholed into any particular type of movie.
Musical.
It's not a musical.
I pigeonhole it as a musical slash comedy.
It's not, though, at all. I think of it as this romantic dramedy with music, and so that's why I liked it so much, is that it's unique and it's different, and everybody was kind of watching it from a different perspective. It's not an ensemble movie by any stretch. I mean, there's so many movies out there. Collateral Beauty is an ensemble movie. Moonlight's ensemble.
Moonlight is the best ensemble of the year.
Hell or High Water. Absolutely. Ensemble. Hidden Figures ensemble. Those are movies where there's equal weight distributed among several different characters. La La Land is Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. And so you can't put them into, I don't think, a best cast category. I think you need to look at La La Land as a best picture for its overall appeal. You can individually look at the two actors for acting awards, but I'm not so sure that they wouldn't. You know, I don't think they're going to rise to the... They're not going to win. But when you take all the individual pieces of this movie, to me, it all adds up to just a really good, intriguing, different, spectacular kind of movie in terms of the music numbers and the twists and turns that it takes. And it took me a second viewing to really appreciate this movie. I did not like it as much the first time I saw it, because I saw it at the Middleburg Film Festival on a relatively small screen in uncomfortable chairs with a mediocre sound system in a hotel ballroom. But then a month later, I saw it in a real theater, great sound system, big screen, and I appreciated it so much more. And so this is not a movie that people should wait and see on TV as a streaming movie. They should go and see it in a really good theater and really take in and appreciate the score and the original songs that will actually also be nominated.
Speaking of the songs, the big song, the one that just won Best Song at the Critics' Choice Awards, is they're saying it's City of Lights. They're saying City of Lights is the best song. And I actually disagree. City of Stars, sorry. In my opinion, it's not. I think it's...
The audition song that she
does? No, that one's way too weepy.
Oh, there's the opening number song.
No, and that one gets on my nerves.
It's Another Day of Sun.
They're dancing as the sun is setting, and like they're telling each other how they're not meant to be.
Oh, right.
Like What a Night or something
like
that.
Yeah, I think I jotted that one down.
And that's where the movie poster comes from, is that song.
Right.
And I think that's my favorite song. This is directed by Damien Chazelle. I would not think this would be in his wheelhouse. He directed Whiplash. An anti-musical, even though it was about music. It was about the drummer and his persecution tutelage under an extreme sadomasochist.
I loved Whiplash.
Whiplash was great, mm-hmm. and he made a name for himself, and I think it's because of Whiplash he got the green light to make La La Land. And everyone's saying, it's so brave, it's so courageous for you to make a musical. Like, no, you forget. Moulin Rouge, Chicago, 9, Into the Woods... It's not brave to make a musical. You just forget that there are musicals and they do make money. And they think, people don't go see musicals anymore. Of course they do, and they still win awards. So, no, it's not that brave.
But it's not that type of musical. And so I think a lot of people are going into this expecting to see something that's more along the lines of a traditional musical. And this really isn't. I mean, Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling are not powerhouse singers and dancers.
No.
But they're... much more relatable because...
It makes it real.
It makes it real. And so when they do some things that are, outside of the realistic world, like dancing in the air at the Griffith Observatory, they have this gravity-defying dance number that sort of takes you out of, out of the real world for a moment. But that's the point of this particular kind of movie. They don't break into song and dance every 5 minutes. They're not songs that are designed to be one sound, one song after another on some extensive soundtrack. It's City of Stars kind of comes back several times throughout the movie, and they're triggers to plot points. And I just really thought the chemistry between Gosling and Stone is really good. It's their third movie together. There's definite on-screen chemistry there, and it works here, and it's the combination of elements that makes it a winner for me.
Gosling and Stone are supposed to remind you of Fred and Ginger, because Fred and Ginger were in a lot of movies together, and people already identify Gosling and Stone as being in movies together. They actually weren't in very good movies together. They were in Gangster Squad as very supporting characters, and they were in Crazy Stupid Love as supporting characters. So this is the first time we see them center screen together. But I think that's why they did that. Just they don't want to bring in two actors you've never seen together. That's not Fred and Ginger. And I applaud, thumbs up the reality. These aren't the greatest dancers. They're not the greatest singers. But these are two real people, except for the first song, which leads off the movie, which is... It's like an American in Paris. That's how fanciful it is. They shut down a freeway in L.A. Traffic. Okay, I get it. L.A. has traffic and... It's just random people getting out of cars singing in this huge, what becomes an immense set mm-hmm. piece. And that's the most unreal thing of it. That's a musical. That is suspension of disbelief musical. Then the rest of the film is actually everything that's not.
Right. It's interesting that people might think, watching the first 6 minutes of this scene that's just this extravaganza on the 105 exchange, that the colors and the jubilation that exists in that opening number is setting the tone for the entire movie, when in fact it's not. It takes some interesting turns and the tone shifts throughout the movie. And so you might think from the first number that that's the kind of movie you're going to see, but in fact it's really not. And some people I think might not like that so much, and then others will appreciate just that how interesting it is to see the dynamic of the two different worlds. And the idea with these characters is that, L.A. is a place for dreamers, and people are always struggling to break through. And she plays this, aspiring actress who's serving coffee at the Warner Brothers lot coffee shop and wants to you know, hustles off to auditions for really crappy roles. And then you've got him who wants to be he's a serious jazz pianist who wants to open up his own club. But in order to get the money to do that, he's got to play some really soul-draining gigs at like playing jingles at a piano bar or playing a pool party in Hollywood Hills. And so the idea is that the two support each other in trying to make their dreams happen and trying to keep their relationship together at the same time. And what makes the movie poignant is the question as to, is that possible and what's going to happen and can they have it all?
You point out the paradox between these characters that by the end, it really impacts you. I felt the ending, and I think it's the best ending of the year.
Mm-hmm.
These two needed each other to progress. He told her, you know what, don't rely on these casting directors. Why don't you go write your own thing? Write and star in your own thing. If you want to be an actress, go make yourself an actress. And at the same time, she tells him, you know what, you're going to have to compromise a little bit. You can achieve your dream, but it's not going to be this traditional 70-year-old jazz that nobody pays attention to anymore. And once they do that, once they launch themselves on that path and somewhat succeed, it actually drives them apart. They cannot stay together anymore. And that's, you know, will they, won't they dichotomy is, wow, what, they needed each other and then they can't have each other. That's pretty weighty for a musical.
It is. And a lot of people perceived the ending very differently. So everybody came out of it kind of projecting, I think, parts of their own histories onto what it all means and where it all leads. And to me, that's the fascinating part. You like when we can process movies. This is one where I think it really took a little bit of processing at the end, more so than I think people would necessarily expect when you see just the trailer or you see just the song and the dance. There's a lot more depth and poignancy and humor and heart to this movie.
He almost cheats a little bit at the end. I'm not going to say it's an ending for everybody, you know, pick your ending, but it's close to cheating, but it's so original and creative that it works. This could have fallen off a cliff at the end, but he held on to it, and man, that's one hell of an ending.
Yeah, and so you put all these things together, and that's what makes, I think, best movie of the year, something that almost everyone should be able to go into and enjoy on some level.
Well, you saw the next one that I did not have a chance to see, which was Collateral Beauty. Tell us about it.
Well, that one's another sort of bittersweet drama. I think it's released now to kind of bring you back to a Christmas Carol type of story or It's a Wonderful Life. And the premise is that this guy, Howard, he's this high-powered fun-loving ad exec, and there's a tragedy in his life, and the film opens and you learn that he lost his 6-year-old daughter a couple of years before, and when that happened he just kind of checked out of life, and he's very angry and bitter, and he spends all of his days just like constructing domino things that he then just knocks over, and his coworkers and friends are very worried about him.
We're talking about Will Smith?
Yes. So Will Smith is playing Howard, and he's very good. And again, this is a really good ensemble movie. His friends are like Michael Pena is in it, and Kate Winslet, and Edward Norton. I mean, we're talking really good, strong supporting characters. And so they play these coworkers who end up hiring a trio of actors to answer these letters that Howard has written to time, love, and death. So these letters that he's written have been intercepted and given to these actors who then appear in his life and essentially slam him for writing these letters where he accuses them of essentially ruining his life and just, you know, the fact that time, death, and love were messing with the universe and messing with him, and he's bitter and angry. And so you've got my favorite, Helen Mirren plays death, like the personification of death, and she is wonderful. I loved her in Eye in the Sky earlier this year. She's really good in this. You've got Keira Knightley plays Love. And so,
of course she does.
Yes. And so she has to sort of respond to his efforts to just abandon Love from his life entirely. And then you've got this other kid who played Time. And he is, you know, just very funny. And he just pops up. He's like this skateboard riding guy, young guy who absolutely embraces this opportunity to act. And so all three of them, it's hard to explain, but it's a really, really poignant, interesting movie. And it's about love and loss and sort of learning from each other. And, it's got what in some cases seems like a horrible premise. Like these friends hire these actors to, you know, try and convince this guy in some respects that he's fallen off the rails because, you know, nobody else sees them, death, love, and time when they pop up. But they, you know, their intentions are good and they set this whole thing in motion in order to save their company and at Christmas time especially. And so it's, and to just bring him back into the world of the living. And it's just a very good film. It's a little difficult to watch in parts, but it's ultimately very uplifting.
You know what this reminds me of is 7 Pounds. Will Smith as this sad sack of a soul who has some master plan to fulfill after a personal tragedy a couple years ago. That's what it reminds me of. 7 Pounds was what, 2009, 2010, something like that, 2009. That's exactly what it sounds like. But hey, right on.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, you had in A Christmas Carol where you have the Christmas past, present, and future visiting the guy. It takes a little bit of that and a little bit from It's a Wonderful Life where it's like, here's what the world would have looked like if you hadn't existed. And so it kind of brings those stories into a much more modern setting. And everybody kind of learns from the experience, the actors, the friends and the coworkers, they all learn something. And in the end, it's about recognizing the collateral beauty that surrounds even in the midst of tragedy.
Well, our final film of the podcast is the brand new testament, Le Tout Nouveau Testament. It's from Belgium, and it was nominated already this year, earlier this year, so, you know, I think almost a year ago, for a Golden Globe for Best Foreign Film. So it's new here, but it's not new. It's been out for a while, and it only just achieved U.S. distribution. That's why we are just getting it now. It's by a director named Jaco van der Mel, and it is just amazing. It begins with just the simplest, most succinct lines, and it tells you where it's going. God exists. He lives in Brussels. And then we find out he's just a miserable man. He's very mean. He's mean to his wife. He's mean to his daughter. He has a daughter. Jesus existed, and he already did his Jesus things. And he spends his days writing the rules. You know the rules. If you drop your toast, it's going to land jam side down. If you immerse yourself in a tub, the phone's going to ring. You know, that's his rules, and he does that on purpose. The world, his daughter, Ia, it recognizes, you know what, the world doesn't have to be this way, and anybody else would do a better job. So after she causes some trouble and gets a beating, she does something very retribution. She publishes the death dates. Everyone on Earth gets a text message, and it tells them the day they're going to die. We've got some people that are going to die in 10 seconds, and we've got the one guy who goes clubbing to celebrate.
Kevin.
Who's going to win. He's going to live 102 years or something.
Is that what it was?
And so she goes down to Earth. She's going to do a better job. She's going to get some apostles. God gets pissed. He goes down to Earth. What a brilliant film, Hannah.
It's very funny. It's like a very dark, twisty turn on the Oh God movies of the late 70s with George Burns, if anyone ever saw those, where this idea that God is among us, you know? And so, but not only is he among us, but he uses humanity as his playthings and sits at his computer all day manipulating people and their actions and having fun with making their lives miserable. And his daughter is just fed up, and she hacks into his computer program and generates this message that basically tells everyone through text when they're going to die. And it's funny. It's like in order to get to regular Earth people, she goes through a washing machine portal, and and comes out and stumbles upon a homeless man that she then determines will write this New Testament for her, write down the brand New Testament. And she goes in search of these six additional apostles because 12 was one of her father's numbers because it represented the number of people on a hockey team. And her mother liked baseball, so she was like 18. Why not 18? So she goes in search of six more apostles, and they're like, you know, a sex addict, and Catherine Deneuve shows up as an apostle.
One of the apostles is Catherine Deneuve, and she has an interesting friendship with a gorilla.
Yeah, I mean, it was like,
there's the sex maniac, there's the assassin.
Right, right.
It's a very oddball apostles, but it works. And I think my favorite one was little boy
who wants to be a girl.
Yeah, he's got 50 some days to live, and he says, you know, all right, fine, I want to be a girl.
Yeah.
And man, this, it's just so many twists and turns, and it gets pretty heavy at times between the apostles, and God gets really mad. He's like, you know, you're messing with my creation. And I loved the central question and the answers, how it tries to answer it. If you know the day, the second you're gonna die, then God is meaningless. Caution goes out the window. You don't need anything. You don't need God. God ceases to exist if you know when you're gonna die.
Yeah, I mean, the Kevin character is hysterical because he's sort of like Kenneth from South Park. It's like he just keeps doing these jackass stunts and dying or almost dying. And you're like, but he knows that it's not his time yet. And so he just pushes the limits on everything. And then, you know, the whole Catherine Deneuve thing with the gorilla, I'm like, it's a little creepy and gross. But it's so off the charts that it's funny. It's absurd. It's just total absurdist comedy. And it does somehow make you think. And I didn't know what I was going to think about it. But in the end, again, it's another one that takes a little bit of processing after watching it. But anybody who might be interested in finding some really quirky foreign film where it really is about this guy in Belgium who's God.
I just had so much fun. I recognized while I was watching it, I'm having fun here. I really like this, and how it's going about it. It's now one of my top two foreign films of the year. It's now on my original screenplay list. It's so original. It's up there with The Lobster, with originality and creativity. I urge everyone to find this. Unfortunately, if you're not in a major city, it will not be screening on a screen your year. But this is something that's going to show up on Netflix, and I'm going to be watching for it because I want to tell you again to go see this. You're going to have so much fun.
But it was interesting when we talked to one of our WAFCA cohorts at the Washington Film Critics Association, Nell, who usually knows everything about every movie coming out, was not aware of this one. And so it's amazing to me that even among critics, this film just hasn't cracked the consciousness of a lot of people, and people who I think would really, really like it. And I even would put it in my probably in my top five for foreign films, because
you get stuff like Things to Come, which everyone saw and heard of, and it's, you know, it's okay.
And Elle.
And compare this to the one that's really sweeping up awards now, Tony Erdmann.
Which
one would you rather watch?
I much preferred the Brand New Testament to Tony Erdmann, and I put it up there. I kind of put it just below. I still liked A Man Called Ove better.
Yeah.
But it's got a lot of the same cynicism in it, and so I think I like those both for very similar reasons. But so I kind of put it up there with those movies. And again, it's nice to have a foreign film that I can watch, even if it's got subtitles, where it's not overly oppressive and violent and sad. It's really quirky and funny.
Yeah, and that's rare, especially for you in a foreign film.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about, very quickly, some awards that are going on. There's a helicopter going by. You can hear that. The Screen Actors Guild Award nominations were released this morning, and I want to talk about one I was shocked was included, because now all these nominations are coming out, the same people are being nominated, the same exact categories. So I want to talk about someone who was included today that I hadn't seen yet, and two, I think, who were snubbed, who should have been there and were not. So the one who was included today was for Best Actress, Emily Blunt in The Girl on the Train.
Yeah.
What is she doing there?
It's that was a surprise, because even though her performance is very good, it just didn't have that breakout feeling that an Oscar or a SAG Award nomination should really carry with it.
She took, you can tell whose place she took, Isabelle Huppert. Now, I don't know if Isabelle would be eligible for a SAG Award, but that's whose place she took.
But I think if you go back to when Girl on a Train came out, her performance was touted that even, you know, that the movie was good.
She wasn't even the best actress in that movie. That was Hayley Bennett.
Hayley Bennett was very good in that, too. But she, you know, I think it was supposed to be this movie role that would take her to, like, that next level.
It wasn't even a very good movie.
And so, I mean, it was a decent movie, but yeah, not, I guess, they really did feel like they just had this extra slot open, and it could have gone to any number of people, including Isabelle Huppert, if she would be eligible, which she probably isn't for this particular group. I think for me, the biggest you'll mention the snubs. I'm not so sure that the snubs to me are actually snubs.
The one I'll do it in reverse order. There's the one I just shocked about and hate, and then there's the one that okay. I miss it, but I understand. Joel Edgerton for mm-hmm. Best Actor in Loving. Loving didn't receive one award, not one nomination, which is shocking. That's an actor's movie. I don't know who really took Joel Edgerton's place. Not, you know, Casey Affleck's in there, but you know, it's sad. He's in my top five. I'm surprised he's not in there. And Loving for anything.
It was a tough one, though. I'm not surprised because the roles to me. Loving to me was not a great movie. It was a very good movie. I love that the story was being told, but I didn't think it was a great movie.
Oh, like Ryan Gosling was in there. No.
No, I would. I still would keep Ryan Gosling in there above Joel Edgerton, absolutely, because there was a lot more to what Ryan Gosling had to pull off in this movie. And
Denzel, I haven't seen Fences yet, but Denzel was in there.
That's an automatic. Honestly, I've seen Fences. It is a masterclass in acting, regardless of what you'd think about the movie as a whole. It's like watching a play. So that doesn't surprise me at all. Viola Davis in Fences. You're like, all right, she's going to get nominated. But the one that I was happiest to see is I think I saw in their best cast or ensemble, maybe it was Hidden Figures.
Yeah, it was. In fact, a lot of people, Octavia Spencer got nominated for that.
Yeah. And so I don't think any of the individuals would deserve to win, but I absolutely loved Hidden Figures. And so I did think that there are so many, there's, you know, four really incredible, strong performances because Kevin Costner is very good in that movie, too. And so you have him in addition to Taraji P. Henson and Octavia Spencer and
Janelle Monáe.
And so, I was glad to see that added because I hadn't heard enough about that one and I felt like it was getting short-shrifted a little bit.
Well, the one that hurts, the one that stings the most is, in my opinion, the year's best supporting actor, Michael Shannon in Nocturnal Animals. And I think he was replaced by the kid who just was a kid. It didn't really do that. Lucas Hedges in Manchester by the Sea. Just because he's a kid with, you know, involved in some tragedy. He might make you tear up once.
Oh, come on.
Does not make him better than Michael Shannon.
He's not a kid.
He's a kid.
He's like 18. But I think his role, Michael Shannon is just great in everything. He just is. And I'm not sure.
Especially in this one.
I don't think enough. I'm not surprised. When I was thinking about what was really going to break through to people, Nocturnal Animals is just not a big enough movie to stick with people.
I mean, you already know who's going to win. It's going to be Mahershala Ali for
Moonlight.
Which it should
be.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And that's fine, even though I wouldn't vote. He's great, but yeah, he's my number two to Michael Shannon. But Lucas Hedges?
Yeah, but when you think that Lucas Hedges, like for the WAFCO Awards, got, you know, best young actor or youth performance.
Which he shouldn't have gotten. Should have gotten the kid from A Monster Calls. The kid from Lion.
And I would have thought the kid from Lion. But I thought that by having him in that category... It's difficult because it's Casey Affleck's movie, and so he'll probably get in there for, you know, best actor, but...
Andrew Garfield was the other one.
Lucas Hedges still had to carry a pretty hefty load in that movie.
I do not understand the love for Lucas Hedges here.
Jeff Bridges
is in this category, too, and he should, you know, if...
I did. See, I actually would. I thought Jeff Bridges for Hell or High Water.
He was much better than
ranked, but I would put him even above, slightly above Michael Shannon And so it's a tough call. There's a lot of performances this year that sort of are all equal weight. There's very few that are like just once you get over the one that you think or know is going to win, the other four slots are almost, you know, well, we can go this way or that way or this way or that way. And so none of them were shocks. And the snubs were not aggressive snubs where I would go, oh my gosh, I can't believe they put this in instead of that. I just felt that it was like, all right, you got to make a choice, just like we do with pretty much every time we do want to cast one of our ballots or fill out a poll, you're making a gut choice. And so when people are following their gut, they're going to go with what they saw. And I don't think as many people saw Nocturnal Animals.
All right. Well, yeah. A brief recap. Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Yeah, I love that Star Wars is back, but, you know, didn't blow me out of the water.
Yeah, it's good, but it's not the best film of the weekend, even though it will be the most biggest moneymaker of the weekend.
La La Land. I know it's your best film of the year. It's in my top 10.
10?
Yeah, it's okay. In my top. It might crack 5. It's 5 or 6. Uh-huh. It'll hit you. It's really good.
It's one of those movies that I've seen 3 times now and probably will see it a few more.
Collateral Beauty,
it's a tough one to pick to go see. You've got to be in the right frame of mind for a somewhat melancholy, bittersweet movie. But if that's what you're looking for, then look for it because it's a really good cast.
And the Brand New Testament, we've talked about a lot of drama on this episode and tragedy. This one's just funny and it'll make you feel good.
Yeah, in a very bizarre sort of way. It's absurd comedy and it's R-rated. It's definitely an R-rated absurd movie.
I didn't think it was so R-rated.
Oh, when that guy is like going to all the brothels and stuff. And
yeah, that's.
There's a lot of topless women. There's a ton of topless women in this movie.
You've
been seeing too many French films lately, Charlie.
Not so topless women.
You know, you're forgetting what makes an R-rated movie.
Well,
it just
reminds me that wouldn't be R-rated in France.
It wouldn't be R-rated in France, but it would definitely be R-rated here in America.
Puritans. All right. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you for listening.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.